This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Gabe Ramirez, Hub Arc, is hanging out with you guys for another hour. We'll be talking some Cubs baseball in just a little bit. Andy Martinez from the Marquee Sports Network going to jump on and talk to us about those 4-2 Cubbies. Looking good at the start of the season. Hub, Caitlin Clark is a phenomenon like nothing else I've seen. Not only is she, you know, and obviously I was around during the LeBron stuff, but he didn't play in college basketball and didn't have the platform, you know, kind of like this. And then I'd also say Caitlin Clark, along with a long list of talented NCAA women's basketball players, have really taken this thing to a level that most people probably thought women's basketball, college basketball, would never be able to get to.
Yeah, I mean, the most obvious thing about her, I think, is that she is the best three-point shooter I've ever seen, man or woman. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, it's like me shooting a five-footer. I mean, she, you know, but what's even more impressive is that I'm not even sure that's her best talent. I mean, you made the point, we were talking off the air, you know, that her defense and her assists and her passing, she is the most dominant athlete I think that I've seen in any sport, at least in the last 5 or 10 years, if not forever. And I've never seen her have a bad quarter, let alone a bad game, you know. And I'm going to be perfectly honest. I don't want to get anybody mad at me. I'm not a huge women's basketball fan. Yeah. Ladies, I have nothing against you or nothing against your game. And I am watching it now because of Caitlin, you know, and I hope that you're enjoying it. And I'm not knocking the sport. It just doesn't interest me as much. I can't watch it. But when she's playing, I'm fixed to it. You know, I can't help it. And how many athletes in our lifetime have we seen like that? I mean, she's just that special.
That's the most impressive thing about it. Even my dad, just I come in the house yesterday or over the weekend, and he's just like, "Did you check out that Caitlin Clark?" I'm like, "What? What are you talking about?" Like, I was right here, me and your mom. My mom was watching Caitlin Clark too. But they talked about it. You know, the game was one of the most watched there, and she is a part of that. And she actually talked about, you know, the momentum of women's college basketball and what it's like right now in the present.
I think the parity in our game has certainly helped over the course of the last, you know, whatever, 5 years. I think there's, you know, there's always been the blue bloods that have been really good, but I think, you know, over the past few Final Fours, you've seen teams that maybe haven't been there in 25, 30 years, and I think that's really good for our game. It attracts new fans. It showcases new players. It showcases new coaches. And I think also the amount of stars we have in our game, especially the young stars we have in our game. I think this freshman class really put on a show this year. You know, they had me watching. They had everybody around the country watching. And I think the beauty is most of them are going to have to stay and play for 4 years. And they're just going to get better and better. Their teams are going to get better and better. And that will also additionally help the parity in our game and attract more people to want to watch. So I think those two things are, you know, the most exciting part about the future of women's college basketball.
Caitlin Clark talking about the momentum of women's college basketball. She talked about, you know, players having to stay for 4 years, which I think is the main reason why women's college basketball is not only more palatable, but people are watching because you understand these stars are there. This isn't the men's game where they leave after one season. And we actually have talked to some people where they say, hey, they should change that rule for women, where if they play the freshman year and they're good enough to go to the WNBA and they want to go, they should go. They shouldn't have to stay there. But it goes back to the point where you do follow players like Caitlin Clark. You have the benefit of watching her play for Iowa. For Reese, you get to see her at LSU, the transfer portal, allowing players to stay in respective teams. It does make it interesting because she also mentioned, Hub, the Blue Bloods, right? Those that we're used to, the Tennessees of the world, the UConns of the world. And that's actually the team she's going to be facing in the Final Four is going to be UConn. It'll be interesting to see if she can continue that run to a national championship.
Yeah, I think not, because I think UConn, the team, has more talent than her team. But she has shown she can beat pretty much anybody by herself. So it's going to be a fun game to watch. There's no question about that.
Yeah, she talked, I'll play one more clip for you. She said what she learned from last year's Final Four, maybe how she can take some of that knowledge, information, to take her to that mountaintop.
Being here last year, you're not really prepared for everything that goes on outside of the game. There's so many distractions. There's so many events you have to attend. There's so many obligations that you have to do. And, you know, your main focus is to come here, and you're playing in the biggest basketball games of your career. So I think being able to block all that out and really lock in and focus on what your job is and what you're here for, and, you know, knowing we're not satisfied. So I think that's the biggest thing, is soak all that in and enjoy it. But at the same time, you know, this is business. You know, we're here to win a basketball game and hopefully win two.
It'll be cool. Cool for the sport if she ends up winning, because the legend will continue to grow, breaking all types of records. I mean, Hub, even when you go to some sports aggregating sites, usually you like click, you know, if you want to check a sport out, you click a thing, a button, and the drop down is there. Then, you know, you got NFL on top, always. MLB, because that's what's in season, and NBA, because that's there. And then the next one is NCAA men's basketball, which March usually there, but the women's one's right under that. Mm-hmm. It's like that thing is creeping up the top, moving up to, it's just, it's amazing that I mean, is it as simple as there's greatness in front of us, so that's why there are more eyes on the sport? Or is it like she mentioned, you know, the players staying there a long time, there being more parity with different teams? What would you liken it to?
Well, it's a bit of a bigger topic. I before you started asking me, I was thinking about something else, mm-hmm. and I thought, I don't want to go there because nobody wants to hear old people
We're
talk
there.
About it. I just think, you know, I'm in an age now where everything has changed from when I was your age, is what it amounts to. And most people like me think, it's gotten worse or it's not as good. I don't think that, but I don't think the difference is positive. You know, I think that college sports, I think, are being ruined. Mm-hmm. You know, this whole NIL stuff is ruining it. The transfer portals. Yeah. You know, who is that good for? You know, the women not coming out early yet. I don't think the men should come out early. It's bad for college basketball. Mm. And it doesn't help any. Who does it benefit? You know, these young men are going to get their money at 22 or 23 instead of 19. You know, it's not like that's a big difference. And I just think that it's more about the colleges trying to generate more revenue so they have more money to spend on running the college. And that's a good thing, I guess. I want all kids to go to good colleges. But I just think that college sports is being ruined right now.
Talk to me about because I understand the transfer portal. I'm in full agreement there. I think that is odd and murky and just not good for the game. But the NIL money, I have zero problem with that. I love the fact that student athletes are able to earn income off of their name, image, and likeness. What part of that don't you like?
What part of it I don't like is that it's changed the competitive nature of the college game. And again, it's not like they're not going to get money out of their name, image, and likeness. They just got to wait a couple more years for it. That's all. And it's now leading to, we're now seeing all kinds of problems in college sports where people are cheating with the NILs and with the transfer portals and more. It isn't going to get better. More negatives are going to come. And my question is, how is it good for the sport? How is college basketball getting better because of, you know, the transfer portals and the money? It's not. You know, I don't see any improvement.
Yeah, I can totally understand where the NIL money and the packs that come as a result of it, where particular teams have more money to give to certain athletes and they're giving money under the table that's outside of the realms of what they're supposed to give, that I agree with. I think it incentivizes players to stay a little longer in their respective teams, especially on the male side, where, you know, look at a guy like Zach Edey, from Purdue, you know, the big behemoth, 7'4". You know, he's a projected 10 to 20 pick in the NBA draft right now. But he stays for another year because he says, well, damn, do I want to be a backup center in the NBA? Or do I want to live the luxurious life of the, you know, college basketball player of the year because I know I'm going to make $6 million or whatever that is, $2 million. And I think it incentivizes certain players to stick around maybe a year or two longer than it would, which then ultimately helps the game. But it circles back to your point, which ultimately then benefits the university that they're playing for because, you know, they got more eyes on them. They go deeper in the tournament. They do those kinds of things. It's tough. It's tough.
Well, and the concept of the NIL money isn't about making the game better or the sport better. It's about, you know, it's about getting the athletes you want. It's not even about treating the athletes better. And 90% of them, I don't know what the actual percentage is, are already getting free college scholarships. You know, and that is, depending on the school they go to,
$40,000-$50,000 a year.
It's 100,000. It's 125. I mean, they're already getting a lot of value for being great athletes. I don't think they need more 2 years sooner than they're going to get it in the pros. Now, some will say that, you know, a lot of them aren't going to get money in the pros, but they're not going to get NIL money either. They're not the people that are getting the NIL money. So I just think that it's not what's best for the game.
Yeah. I guess there are arguments to be made. I think if I'm a college athlete and I see my university making $1 billion and I know that I'm the star player on the team, yes, I know I'm going to get it 2 years from now. But in the present, I'm feeling like an employee that isn't getting paid his fair share or his worth of whatever this entity is, because no college athlete is going to Michigan saying, I mean, actually, they are saying that they're going to get a great education because Michigan is one of the amazing schools. Shout out to my niece, by the way, who's going on her visit up there to the University of Michigan.
Oh, good luck.
Yeah, but I also think it's because they understand that, you know, they're going to be playing in a high leverage school that's going to be competing for national championships. They're going to have the exposure there. And then when the money comes in, they're like, yeah, I get to benefit from that. It's tough. NIL is interesting. I think there will be reform. It's inevitable. It's just... They just open Pandora's box with no rules, and then something is going to happen where eventually they do. Let me ask you, which would you prefer to get rid of if you had to choose one, the transfer portal or the NIL? Because then what if you were getting NIL money, transfer portal's closed, so you have to just make it with your team and you can't go anywhere?
You know, I don't know that I have as much of a problem with the transfer portal because anybody who's not an athlete can leave one school and go to another one.
Good counterpoint.
You know, I mean, and even with that, why are they transferring? Very few top-end players are transferring. It's the ones who are not playing as much or doing as well as they want to and think they're going to do better at the next school they go to. I mean, I don't know. I haven't talked to all the people who've transferred, but I bet if you asked them, you're not going to find many who said, I'm transferring because I'm going to a better school. They're right. Transferring because they think they have a better chance to play and become a pro. You know, and I think I'm okay with that. I mean, I don't like it. You know, I don't think any school is going to like it unless they're getting better players than they're losing.
Yeah.
You know, but right. But the NIL money, I have various problems with. I just don't think it's necessary.
That's an interesting one, Hub. Because I feel like you'd be on the side of, you know, young people, you know, having the ability to earn a little bit more money off of their talent in college.
I'm fine with them earning more money off their talent, just not in college, because they're already being paid to play in college. Yeah. Over $100,000 of free scholarship money, you know. And so all we're saying, now we're saying that's not good enough. They need millions. No, they don't need millions. Most of us never make millions.
Yeah, you know? But I would love them to make an extra $100,000. Right. If they're getting that scholarship and they've earned that with their talents, and then the school is profiting off of them, and then they have, again, I'm not, and I do agree with the $1 million things. Mm-hmm. That's a hell of a lot of money that 98% of the people are never going to make. Right. So that, but, you know, I try to think, you know, a little, you know, 10, 15, 20,000 in the bank account, you know, like, and I think that's the side that I'm arguing now that I'm saying it out loud. Where I understand some college athletes being super broke, maybe not coming from money, don't have the luxury of, you know, having their parents just send them $500 or whatever. And then they get, you know, $15,000 because they did a, you know, autograph signing at a dealership. And mm-hmm. I'm okay with that. I like that. As someone that worked several jobs in college and how much that sucked to have to do that. Like if somebody just slapped me with a couple of thousand, I'd get it. But again, that's why I think there will be reform, because I think both sides have good arguments, but I think it is a little out of control to where they'll have to just rein it in a little bit, maybe put a cap on it, maybe, you know, do something along the lines to curb what it is that that's happening. Because we see them saying, hey, you know, like, let's say like a guy like DJ Ugalele, you know, plays for Clemson. He goes out to Oregon State. And then they're like, well, yeah, we want you to come here because we're going to give you $1 million. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's the part that I'm not cool with. Right. I'd rather them be at a school, be the face of that school. And then, you know, the dealership down the block wants to give them some money because they represent that squad.
Well, and Gabe, it can only get worse because it's already become a big competition for which schools have the most NIA money. And you know, the guy's getting $5 million now. 4 years from now, they're going to be getting $10 million
quickly.
And 8 years from now, they're going to be getting $20 million. It's just going to keep growing and getting worse.
Yeah. And that's going to be the big issue that NCAA is going to have to deal with.
And there's already concern about, and where is this money coming from? We know it's coming from wealthy alums.
Yeah.
But where are they getting it? You know, and how legal is it all? And it just leads itself to so much negativity that I don't think the college sport needs.
Yeah, and it's funny because on, I think it was on Mullion Hall, they had the athletic director for DePaul before they hired their new coach, the former head coach of Ohio State. And one of his main talking points was about, you know, the NIL pool money and how it will be right in a year or two or like next year. But it just sounded odd coming out of an athletic director.
Right. Yeah. What does that mean?
Because we finally understand how important it is. So we're reaching out to get more money from that area. But like that, those are the parts that I think is icky about NIL. When people talk like that, as opposed to, again, a player, which I think is the original purpose of it, benefiting off of their name, image, and likeness. You are the star player. You've earned that, you know, by playing a season. People know who you are for fill in the blank college. And now you get to benefit as a result of that, as opposed to, hey, come to my school because I have $1 million for you. Because I have a guy who owns a company and he's willing to write a check for you because he wants you to play here. That's not the same.
And prior to the NIL stuff, it was all about what's the best school and are you going to get the best education, the best, most out of going to college here? Now it's about where can I get the most money? It has nothing to do with how good the school is anymore.
Well, Caitlin Clark's going to be making a lot more of it. I believe she was the highest earner in college sports last year. I think it was $3 million.
Yeah, she generated over the course of her career, she has generated over $82 million in consumer spending in the state of Iowa.
That is unreal. That is unreal.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, she hasn't gotten anywhere near that. She's generated.
Correct. Yeah. She's made about $3 million. But for the state of Iowa, 82. Yeah.
That's wild. That's wild, man. People will eat off that. Another team people will eat off is the Chicago Cubs. And that is from everybody that's working there to most certainly the top of the top brass, and they will continue to eat if the Cubs continue to play this way. We're going to talk about their hot start. Cubs 4-2 right now for the season, and Andy Martinez from the Marquee Sports Network will join us next to talk about that hot start and what does he think about Luke.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Little, doing the back-to-back from the ninth inning to the start of the game. We'll talk to Andy Martinez next, right here on 670 The Score.
Yeah, you're definitely right to doubt that. I don't know where we're getting those numbers from, but even last year when I got to South Bend and High to start last season, they said I was 220 and everyone laughed, and it's not even close.
It's Luke Little right there letting you know he's not too little. It's Gabe Ramirez, Hub Arkish, hanging out here. Got about 35 minutes left, but we need to talk a little bit of Cubs baseball. Cubs 4-2 on the season. Started out a little rough against the Texas Rangers. Got themselves a Colorado Rockies team that's struggling. Exactly what the doctor ordered. And we get to talk about, you know, who this Cub team really is, who they will pan out to be after some series that, you know, probably not good indicators of what that's going to look like. But to do that, joining us right now on the Circus Sports Illinois Hotline. Download the Circus Sports app today. Covers the Cubs for the Marquee Sports Network. All-around good guy, Andy Martinez. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Gabe. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So when you see Luke Little on the lineup card coming out to pitch the first inning, knowing that he just did that in the ninth the day before, initial thoughts?
Yeah, it was always going to be kind of like a bullpen day that day, just with Ben Brown being the call up for Justin Steele and the injury. When Luke Little was announced, I think everyone knew it was going to be an inning and probably more likely just the three hitters that he was going to face. Colorado kind of has the same lineup every single day where it's lefty, righty, lefty, and the pocket of lefties kind of made sense. So I thought it was a good way to kind of break Ben Brown in, get him a little bit more favorable of a pocket of a matchup to go up against. And really kind of get his feet wet and get him, you know, more accustomed to pitching in the major leagues, which is a big point right now because they're going to need him as they try and get back to Jameson Taillon and Justin Steele from injury.
You know, it's so early that I don't want to try and pretend that we've learned, you know, more than we have about where the team is at right now. But I think the guy that is the most interesting to me is Morrell. I mean, you know, this is a guy who looks like he could have an MVP future somewhere at the plate if he has a position on the field. Does he have, I mean, they've talked about playing, I think, at all nine spots. Does he have a natural position? What was he when they first acquired him? And is there any chance that he is going to find a position, or is he going to end up as pretty much a full-time DH?
Yeah, I think the hope is that he can continue to stay at third base, and the early results have been very mixed. You know, he's made some plays, and he's also missed some plays, and he is, as you mentioned, he's electric when he's at the plate, right? His offense, home opener against the Rockies, he creates chaos with a hard single to left field. Like, you want that bat in the lineup every single day. It's really just about finding a positional home right now, and they're hoping it's third base. And Craig Counsell has stressed time and time again that it's not going to be a finished product come, you know, April 1st or May 1st. Like, it's going to take some time for him to really settle in. And the hope is that he continues to get better. Like, I think there's going to be more days like there have been early on in the season where he makes some mistakes or he has some throwing errors. But the Cubs hope that at the end of the season or come September, either he's figured it out or they've realize that it might not happen and they can use him as a DH and continue to keep that bat in the lineup.
He's Andy Martinez right here on 670 The Score, Gabe Ramirez, Hub Arcus. Andy, has Craig Counsell been perfect so far this season?
Yeah, he's not been perfect. And I think he would even admit there's definitely some room for improvement. What I've been impressed with is he came over from Milwaukee and was touted as like a bullpen guy, a pitching staff guy, right? Like, he knew how to manage a bullpen and a pitching staff, and the early results have been pretty favorable in that regard. I thought it was really, really interesting in the second game of the season where it's a 3-run ball game, I believe it was, against the Rangers. So it's a really, really close game, and it's late in the game, and instead of turning to Hector Neris or Julian Merriweather or Mark Light or like one of your leveraged arms, he turns to Ben Brown, lets him get his feet wet and make his major league debut, cover some innings to protect the bullpen. And it's one of those situations where it's still a 3-run game. Like, they're still going to need a lot of offense to get back into it. And the Cubs weren't able to muster that offense, but it allowed you to save all your bullpen arms for the next day. You had a stretch of 4 games in a row and you had gotten short starts. You knew you were going to need your bullpen. It offered some relief to those leverage arms that you really rely on. I thought that was really, really impressive. And those are the things that might get overlooked. Being able to rest a guy on game two and keeping him fresh for a few more days, it's going to help in September. It's going to help in August. It's going to help in October when he's got maybe a little bit less mileage on his arm.
You know, Andy, I find it interesting that I don't hear anybody talking about Justin Steele right now, you know, and I know there's nothing.
They're scared. Yeah. Everybody's scared, huh?
Well, I am. That's why I'm asking. That's where I'm going. I'm not scared so much as I feel like we really don't know much. You know, we know what the injury is. We now know it's going to be at least a month, but he's your number one pitcher. And you're talking about making a run at winning a World Series. And I mean, he could be back in early May. He might not be back until July. We just don't know right now, or I don't know right now. Do you know more than we've heard so far, or what are you being told is where the team is at on where Steele is at?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing for him because it was one of those things when it happened, you're kind of like, oh no, like this looks really, really severe. And he immediately was on the ground and he's holding the back of his leg. It ended up being a grade one hamstring strain. And Craig Counsell said it was kind of almost like best case scenario, right? Like they thought it was worse than it was ended up being. And the hope is that he could come back in early May and kind of provide a jolt to this rotation. I've seen him walking around. If you actually saw him, you wouldn't think anything is wrong with him because he's walking around fine. But as we know, with pitchers and with athletes in general, especially the elite of the elite athletes, they need to be at the tip top of shape. And so it's going to take some time to let the injury actually recover. And then he's really just got to build back up. He's got to build up his innings work, his pitch count, and then he can contribute to the Cubs rotation. But right now, I mean, like I said, if you saw him, he's walking around. There isn't a limp when he's walking around, but there's no running. He's not throwing off a mound, none of that. Like it's really just kind of getting back to 100% right now with his hamstring.
One other pitching question from your perspective, is there a chance that Javier Assad is better than we realize? I mean, because that was really impressive the other day. He was very impressive last year. I haven't seen any negatives yet, and he continues to be treated just kind of like the extra fourth or fifth guy they happen to have, but he's pitched better than that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll admit, like I was the first one that, you know, thinking in spring training, like he's the swing man, right? Like he's going to be the multi-inning relief guy. And when the rotation was fully healthy, it was Steele, Tyone, Hendricks, Imanaga, and you were thinking Wicks and Smiley and Assad as potential swingmen. And Assad has been really, really good, really his whole big league career. If you look up his numbers, I believe it's around 150, 160 innings. His ERA is sub 3. His whip is about 1.27, I believe. Like, he is a really, really dependable major league pitcher and someone who's been overlooked his whole career. Tony and Jackie and I talked about it on the Cubs Weekly podcast where it's like, when he was called up, he was a guy that you were kind of like, well, he's making a spot start. Like they needed someone. This guy's going to come up. And he pitched really well that last month of September in 22. And then in the WBC really took off for Team Mexico, pitching really well against a really strong U.S. lineup. And then last year, if you look up his numbers, like in September, he was one of their best starters. Like yeah. He was throwing, he had an outing in Cincinnati. I believe he won 8 innings and allowed 1 run. Like he was just dominant that mm-hmm. outing in Cincinnati. And it looked like that was the kind of outing that's like, yep, this guy's a playoff rotation arm. He is really, really flown under the radar. And I agree. Like I'll admit, I'm the same way where I definitely underrate what he can be to this Cubs pitching staff.
I'm going to take your Mexican card away because you're disrespecting Javier Assad like that. Don't do it. Don't do it. No, he, I mean, it's what we saw at the World Baseball Classic is what he has, that fire and that desire to be the guy. I mean, you're talking about the swing at the back end of the rotation. I mean, the Cubs have that luxury, right? I mean, they had it last year. You can nitpick about what you felt was, you know, what they should have been. But the fact that the Cubs were able to insert any of those guys that you name is a luxury that not a lot of teams in Major League Baseball that they actually have. Another guy that had a really good first outing, Shota Imanaga. You know, we talked about him before the season, Andy, and, you know, you get to see him firsthand. I love the passion and the excitement. I love his catering to the fan base of the Chicago Cubs. We're hoping this is sustainable, right?
Yeah, he's such an interesting arm because I thought he was going to be better than what we expected, and I thought that first outing was even better than like if he would have said he would have gone 5 innings and allowed like a run or two, you would have taken that, especially given how things had gone the previous three days with the Cubs pitching staff. He goes out there 6 innings, 9 strikeouts. The splitter is a really, really good pitch.
Nasty.
I saw him pitch a minor league game in Arizona against the San Francisco Giants minor league team, and he was throwing his fastball. His fastball is like really deceptive. Like it has a lot of ride and carry on it. And then he plays the slider off of that where they look like the same pitch, and then one just kind of dies and the one continues to rise up. I thought that was what he was going to be doing. And then he breaks up his splitter. That was just, it was a game changer. I mean, the Rockies really had no answer for that pitch. And I think the one concern that I have with Imanaga, he's a fly ball tendency pitcher. I think there's going to be some outings throughout the course of the season where, especially at Wrigley Field, where the wind's blowing out, like he's going to have some outings where it's not going to look pretty. There's probably going to be a lot of home runs. But I think over the course of 162, like, he's going to be a pretty darn good pitcher for this rotation. And like, the emotion he plays with, like, it was so fun to see. Like, I didn't know that that's who he was as a person. Like, he was fired up. He was going bonkers after his last strikeout. Like, it was really awesome to see.
You know, one of the key guys in this lineup is Seiya Suzuki. And I really like him a lot, but I find him hard to trust. He always, defensively, he always seems like he's not quite sure what he's going to do, but he gets it done. And at the plate, I trust him. He's obviously a very good hitter. But he's off to a good start. He had a good second half last year. And he's the Cubs are loaded with guys on this roster who are proving to be better than I think I or we expected. And, you know, I know they paid a lot of money for Suzuki, so that they hope that he is a quality right fielder. But is there a chance that he is now a key guy in this lineup?
Yeah, I definitely think there is. I actually, going back to our podcast, our season preview podcast, my bold prediction was he was going to be getting down ballot MVP votes. Like, I think that's the type of season he could have this season. The last 2 months of last year, I believe he had a 182 weighted runs created plus, which is 82% above league average. Like, he was really, really good. And in spring, he had, I believe, a 456 batting average. Like, he was hitting everything really, really solid. And he's kind of picked that up here at the beginning of the season. One of the things that he really did last season, towards the end of last season, was he picked up a better cage routine with hitting coach Dustin Kelly. And it was not necessarily changing anything in his swing. It was just being, like, more smart with his approach in his pregame routine, where he's taking a little bit less swings. He's only working on, like, what he really wants to work on that day and taking those swings. And then, like, being more aggressive at the plate. If he has a 2-1 count, he's not going to try and work it to a 3-1 count and maybe work a walk. If he gets a pitch he likes, he's going to try and swing at it, and he's probably going to do damage the way he's swinging the bat right now. And it's a real game changer of a bat in the middle of the Cubs lineup.
Seiya is just exactly what you want, right? You got everything around him, and then Seiya, just whatever he does, it's gravy, and you're just hoping that he just does it at a consistent rate, because then if that's the case, everybody else around them is going to contribute as well, which is really fun to watch in a lot of instances. Andy, the Cubs are going to have their hands full over the next, 12 games. Dodgers, Padres, Mariners, then the Diamondbacks. I know it's April, right? And you saw, you know, two opposite ends of Major League Baseball spectrum with the Rangers and the Rockies, but they're going to be tested. What can we expect? What should we be expecting from this Cubs during these next 12 games?
I think it's really going to come down to their pitching. I think their offense has shown that they're able to score. And last season they were sixth in runs scored. And this season they're seemingly picking up right where they left off. And they have almost the same core back, right? It's Christopher Morel, but Bellinger, Ian Happ at the top of the lineup, Nico Horner. Like, it's kind of the same group. They're maybe a little bit better, at least early on. So the offense, I'm not really too concerned about. It's going back to that pitching, and we're getting the second time through now. Like, we're going to see what Kyle Hendricks does tomorrow. We're going to see what Shota Imanaga does his second outing. We're going to see what Jordan Wicks and Javier Assad do. It's going to really come down to that pitching stuff, because there's relief on the way in Tyone and Steele here, and Tyone could come back here in a week or two, and Steele could come back in next month. Having those guys, getting to the point where those guys come back, is really, really crucial. And if they can kind of weather the storm here with this really, really tough April schedule and get those two guys back, it could really put them in a really good position to kick off this summer.
You know, that takes me to my last question. I mean, when you look at this schedule, and we've talked about it, is 500 good enough? You know, because I feel like with the competition, 500 would certainly leave them in a good spot when we get to May. But on the other hand, if they are serious about making a playoff run or a Super Bowl run, do they have to do better than that? And is it not okay not to, just because they're playing the other best teams in the league?
Yeah, it's going to be, I think 500, especially if you told the Cubs with where their pitching staff is at and who they're facing, 500, they'd probably sign up for that. They would probably also say that they could do better, but I think you would sign up for 500 ball against those teams. It should be enough in this division. Like, I think the division it's not the NL West. It's not the AL East. This is a division that it's, you know, 86 wins might be enough to win it. So you just want to stay in that hunt and get through this really, really tough stretch of schedule. And then, you know, hope when the summer comes around and, like I said, these pitchers get back, you're in a good position where you can really make a run and try and run away with the division.
And ultimately, that's what they want to do. Just get hot at the right point and give themselves a nice little cushion. Andy, we appreciate you jumping on as always, man. Have yourself a great weekend.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Andy Martinez from the Marquee Sports Network hanging out with us here. It's going to be tough, Hub. Facing the Dodgers tomorrow, 120. You can hear that right here on 670 The Score. Tough task. Dodgers 7-2. It's just you want the momentum to be you want some positivity there, and you want there to be some momentum. But when tough teams are coming into town, it's tough.
Even with this schedule, I think to feel good about them, you want to be at least, you know, 4, 5, 6 games over 500. But the flip side of it is, if you are seriously a playoff team, why can't they finish 10 games over 500? I mean, you can't just say, well, because the schedule's so tough, you know, just being average now is okay. No. I mean, we've seen Cubs, well, our whole lives, and one thing about Cubs teams, when they start hot and stay hot until they get to the middle of the season, it's going to be a good year.
Yeah.
Okay? When they start slow, it's not going to be a good year. Even if they come out late, it's not going to work out. Yeah. So I don't think they can use the excuse of the tough schedule as a good enough reason to just be 500 or you know, 1 or 2 games over or under in the first month and a half.
I mean, hell, they knew what they were getting into.
Yeah.
Right? They bring in Craig Counsell. They got this team that they got. They're trying to win the NL Central.
And Gabe, you know, obviously getting Cody Bellinger re-signed was the key. And they had to do it, and they did it, and good for them. But other than that, other than you know, the pitcher from across the seas, they didn't make a big offseason move. Yeah. You know, this is the same team that fell apart. No, it's not the same team, but it's a very similar team to the one that fell apart last year. And that's why I hope, first of all, some of the ads they did make are going to be better than we expect. I hope that there's going to be a move or two by the trade deadline. And there is still a chance for them to be a legit contender. But there's still a lot of questions to answer, too.
A lot of good teams in Major League Baseball as well. But, of course, you can always catch all the Cubs action right here on 670. The Score, Cubs taking on the Dodgers tomorrow at 120. Pat Hughes, Ron Coomer, Zach Zeman, they'll take care of you then. All right, we're going to take care of you for one more segment before we get out of here at 9 o'clock. Stick around. Don't go anywhere. It's Gabe Ramirez and Hub Arkish right here on The Score. It's Gabe Ramirez and Hub Arkish right here on 670 The Score. Hopefully we've given you some things to think about, but more importantly, maybe a little bit more knowledge to add onto your Bearsdom or Cubsdom, as it depends on which hour you've been listening. Hub, but it's been a pleasure as always, and it is. But there's 3 weeks heading up to this draft for the Chicago Bears, and there's still a lot of work to do for this team. And, you know, we talked to Pat Finley earlier about, you know, what the floor for expectations look like. And I saw you perk up a bit when you mentioned that Tyson Bagent could lead this team to 6 or 7 victories. What did you think about that statement from Patrick Finley in terms of the floor of the Chicago Bears?
I must have been having a moment because I didn't really think that much of it. I mean, Tyson Bagent's a nice kid, and it was a good story last year, but I think that story's over now. Yeah. I mean, you know, maybe not. He could still be number two or number three.
But floor for expectations for you. For you, or in, you know, what should they be for the Bears?
Well, I mean, I think if they went from 3 wins to 7 wins last year, that they should go to at least 10 wins, maybe even 11 this year, to be continuing to move in the right direction. And I do think with the talent on the roster and the way they played the second half of the season last year, it is a possibility. I haven't even studied their schedule yet. I haven't even looked at all the games, you know, and we don't have the schedule as far as when they're what order they're, you know, there's a lot of factors here that we don't know yet, but I suspect based on the way they finished last year, that anything less than at least 9 or 10 wins is going to be very disappointing for Bears fans.
I feel the same way. Mm. Where now there are expectations. Mm-hmm. Where after the 3-win season, there was uncertainty. Mm-hmm. You weren't necessarily sure what that went. And you and I had good conversations about, guys, they can't win 10. Like plus four wins is good. Mm-hmm. Really good, actually. Mm-hmm. And so but now that they're there, and you said, man, with all the turmoil that happened, with all the drama with Fields and the coordinators and Flus, will he be here? Now, all the hoopla that was going around to still manage that victory total, and then now to see where the Bears are at in the position that they're in right now, you say to yourself, yeah, that floor I feel comfortable saying that the floor should be 6 or 7 wins, that they shouldn't do anything less than that. And if they do, then maybe Coach Flew's job will be up for grabs in the event that that happens.
Yeah, I mean, I have pretty much ignored, you know, most of the conversation around the team. And I've just focused on watching tape, watching the players and the roster moves that they've made. To me, that's the story of the offseason. Yeah. The roster moves they've already made and that they're still going, well, not moves, but additions that they're still going to make. And that's when we're going to really get locked in next month. And I can't, no more excuses for not taking positions on things, because now I'm going to know who we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, but the really hard part about talking about how good or bad the Bears are going to be this year, even if you accept that, you know, Caleb Williams is already a Bear, which I don't, but I think there's a good chance he will be, until we see him play at this level, what kind of predictions are you going to make? I don't know, you know.
And then you might not even see him for a while, right? Because if you think, how much are they going to want to play him in preseason, you know, protect him or, you know.
So I would think they'd want to play him a lot in preseason, though.
Yeah.
Especially if they don't plan on him starting opening day, because that is going to be his first
NFL action.
His first playing with other NFL players. So, yeah. Well, actually, there are some who aren't NFL players in the preseason. Yeah. I do think it's important to get him as much time as they can in the preseason.
Yeah, I'm excited. I think the certain part for us is it becomes a bit exhausting, right? Whether it's the 2-month lead up to the number one pick in the draft, April 26th, after like you said, we're not certain, but it seems as though that'll be the case, Caleb Williams, that then it's going to be from April 26th until August, you know, 4 months of that, people talking about Caleb and what he is going to be. You're just going to be, you know, repeating those same conversations. It's going to be exhausting.
I'll tell you what would be an incredible story. I still think they have to bring in another veteran quarterback just to be prepared for the possibility that they don't want Williams starting, you know, to start the season. So, and they're going to do that. But aside from that, how weird would it be if during training camp and early in the season, it appeared that Tyson Bagent and Caleb Williams were competing with each other for playing time? I'm not predicting it. I'm just saying.
How weird would it be? It'd be very weird if something like that were. Yeah, I like, you know, a guy like Ryan Tannehill, right, where he didn't have the best first couple of seasons, had the resurgence in Tennessee, you know, then obviously hit the back burner with Will Levis. He doesn't necessarily feel as though he needs to be a starter, and he can, you know, he's a little long in the tooth and, you know, kind of give that information to Caleb. I'd like a guy like that. Mm-hmm. Instead of like a Sam, I know Sam Darnold's already signed, but instead of a guy like Sam Darnold where it's like the ultimate journeyman, I'd rather have someone who's started some games at a consistent rate.
Yeah, and I shouldn't say they're going to sign another one, because Darnold is capable of being the temporary quarterback. There's no question about that. I think you'd have to, but if you were hoping that Williams would get an entire year, you know, of learning, then I'd want somebody better than Darnold.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. All right. I want to thank our guests for today. Of course, we had Patrick Finley hanging out with us, Andy Martinez from the Marquee Sports Network, and Trevor Sikkema from PFF breaking down the draft for us. Want to thank our producer, Alex Kuhn.
They want the big bowl of brand in Guadalajara.
He's the big bowl in Guadalajara. Hub, it's always fun talking with you, man.
Really enjoyed it. I always enjoy it, and I look forward to getting to do it again soon.
Yeah, this was a fast one. Guys, you can check this out, this version of the show, if you're just tuning in, on the Odyssey app. Make sure you download that so you can take us with you everywhere you go. Mi gente, that means my people. Hasta la próxima. That means until next time. I am Gabe Ramirez. He is Hub Arkish. This is 670 The Score. Gabe Ramirez and Hub Arkish right here on 670 The Score. Hopefully we've given you some things to think about, but more importantly, maybe a little bit more knowledge to add on to your Bearsdom or Cubsdom, as it depends on which hour you've been listening. Hub, but it's been a pleasure as always, and it is. But there's 3 weeks heading up to this draft for the Chicago Bears, and there's still a lot of work to do for this team. And, you know, we talked to Pat Finley earlier about, you know, what the floor for expectations look like. And I saw you perk up a bit when you mentioned that Tyson Bagent could lead this team to 6 or 7 victories. What did you think about that statement from Patrick Finley in terms of the floor of the Chicago Bears?
I must have been having a moment because I didn't really think that much of it. I mean, Tyson Bajan's a nice kid, and it was a good story last year, but I think that story's over now. Yeah. I mean, you know, maybe not. He could still be number two or number three.
But floor for expectations for you. For you, or in, you know, what should they be for the Bears?
Well, I mean, I think if they went from three wins to seven wins last year, that they should go to at least 10 wins, maybe even 11 this year, to be continuing to move in the right direction. And I do think with the talent on the roster and the way they played the second half of the season last year, it is a possibility. I haven't even studied their schedule yet. I haven't even looked at all the games, you know, and we don't have the schedule as far as when they're what order. You know, there's a lot of factors here that we don't know yet. But I suspect, based on the way they finished last year, that anything less than at least 9 or 10 wins is going to be very disappointing for Bears fans.
I feel the same way. Mm. Where now there are expectations. Mm-hmm. Where after the 3-win season, there was uncertainty. Mm-hmm. You weren't necessarily sure what that went. And you and I had good conversations about, guys, they can't win 10. Like plus four wins is good. Mm-hmm. Really good, actually. Mm-hmm. And so but now that they're there, and you said, man, with all the turmoil that happened, with all the drama with Fields and the coordinators and Flus, will he be here? Now, all the hoopla that was going around to still manage that victory total, and then now to see where the Bears are at in the position that they're in right now, you say to yourself, yeah, that floor, I feel comfortable saying that the floor should be 6 or 7 wins, that they shouldn't do anything less than that. And if they do, then maybe Coach Flus' job will be up for grabs in the event that happens.
Yeah, I mean, I have pretty much ignored, you know, most of the conversation around the team. And I've just focused on watching tape, watching the players and the roster moves that they've made. To me, that's the story of the offseason. Yeah. The roster moves they've already made and that they're still going, well, not moves, but additions that they're still going to make. And that's when we're going to really get locked in next month. And I can't, no more excuses for not taking positions on things, because now I'm going to know who we're talking about, you know, but the really hard part about talking about how good or bad the Bears are going to be this year, even if you accept that, you know, Caleb Williams is already a Bear, which I don't, but I think there's a good chance he will be, until we see him play at this level, what kind of predictions are you going to make? I don't know. You know,
and then you might not even see him for a while, right? Because if you think, how much are they going to want to play him in preseason, you know, protect him, or, you know,
I would think they'd want to play him a lot in preseason, though.
Yeah.
Especially if they don't plan on him starting opening day, because that is going to be his first
NFL action.
His first playing with other NFL players. So, yeah. Well, actually, there are some who aren't NFL players in the preseason. Yeah. I do think it's important to get him as much time as they can in the preseason.
Yeah. I'm excited. I think the certain part for us is it becomes a bit exhausting, right? Whether it's the 2-month lead up to the number one pick in the draft, April 26th, after like you said, we're not certain, but it seems as though that'll be the case, Caleb Williams, that then it's going to be from April 26th until August, you know, 4 months of that, people talking about Caleb and what he is going to be. You're just going to be, you know, repeating those same conversations. It's going to be exhausting.
I'll tell you what would be an incredible story. I still think they have to bring in another veteran quarterback just to be prepared for the possibility that they don't want Williams starting, you know, to start the season. So, and they're going to do that. But aside from that, how weird would it be if during training camp and early in the season, it appeared that Tyson Bagent and Caleb Williams were competing with each other for playing time? I'm not predicting it. I'm just saying.
How weird would it be? It'd be very weird if something like that were. Yeah, I like, you know, a guy like Ryan Tannehill, right, where he didn't have the best first couple of seasons, had the resurgence in Tennessee, you know, then obviously hit the back burner with Will Levis. He doesn't necessarily feel as though he needs to be a starter, and he can, you know, he's a little long in the tooth and, you know, kind of give that information to Caleb. I'd like a guy like that. Mm-hmm. Instead of like a Sam, I know Sam Darnold's already signed, but instead of a guy like Sam Darnold where it's like the ultimate journeyman, I'd rather have someone who's started some games at a consistent rate.
Yeah, and I shouldn't say they're going to sign another one, because Darnold is capable of being the temporary quarterback. There's no question about that. I think you'd have, but if you were hoping that Williams would get an entire year, you know, of learning, then I'd want somebody better than Darnold.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. All right. I want to thank our guests for today. Of course, we had Patrick Finley hanging out with us, Andy Martinez from the Marquee Sports Network, and Trevor Sikkema from PFF breaking down the draft for us. Want to thank our producer, Alex Kuhn.
They want the big bowl of brand in Guadalajara.
He's the big bowl in Guadalajara. Hub, it's always fun talking with you, man.
Really enjoyed it. I always enjoy it, and I look forward to getting to do it again soon.
Yeah, this was a fast one. Guys, you can check this out, this version of the show, if you're just tuning in, on the Odyssey app. Make sure you download that so you can take us with you everywhere you go. Mi gente, that means my people. Hasta la próxima. That means until next time. I am Gabe Ramirez. He is Hub Arkish. This is 670 The Score.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.